Hey, welcome to Kilmeade and Friends. Always great to have Chris Wallace on. In our studio, a guy that goes around the world to the hot spots, the places we're told not to go to. He goes there and writes stories about it. He's in studio. He's the author of Blood Money, now out on paperback. He is traveling all around. David Ignatius from the Washington Post. Welcome back to Kilmeade and Friends.
Brian, it's great to be back. It's great to be back in the USA after some of the crazy places I've been in the last couple weeks. Lebanon, Egypt. We'll talk about that, but it's mighty nice to be home.
Well, I'll tell you what, it takes tremendous courage for you to go do that because everyone writes about it, they have opinions about it, but we're going on secondhand accounts. What is it about you that said, I have to go see for myself?
I've done this for so many years. I first traveled to the Middle East in 1980 as a young journalist for the Wall Street Journal, and it got under my skin. It's been the passion that drove 8 of my novels now. Blood Money is the most recent one. It fascinates me. It horrifies me. I really like that part of the world, and to see it suffer with bad government, with wars that are recurring now, with revolutions and counter-revolutions, it's painful to watch, but I keep going back because I think it's a story that we're caught up in, whether we like it or not.
Well, the thing, it used to be kind of easy to figure out. Okay, Mubarak, Egypt, friend. Lebanon, let's hope we can change it back to the way it was. Syria, evil. Iran, evil. Now, all of a sudden, the Arab Spring. We thought, that's good. Wait a second. Is the Arab Spring really good? And who are these new guys that want power?
My feeling, Brian, is that we should all take a deep breath before we decide who the good guys and the bad guys are. The process of change, the process that takes a sick, broken political culture, which was so obvious in Syria. It's a country just so backward. Bashar al-Assad has been a dictator, as his father was. The process of the change there that creates a more modern country, more democratic country, gives more opportunities to the Syrian people. That's a fabulous process. But along the way, it's really going to be dangerous. And I think we need to be very careful about pumping money and weapons into groups where we don't even know who they are. Some of these groups clearly have links with the remnants of al-Qaeda. We got to be careful about supporting them. There was a story that was in the New York Times and on Fox News this morning about the CIA beginning to work with the opposition groups in Syria. It's my understanding what they're trying to do basically is just find out who these people are. Who are you? What are your goals? Who are you linked with? And then we can maybe make better decisions about who to support.
It's unbelievable because I know Senator McCain was just in your seat a couple of weeks ago and was saying, how can we sit on the side and allow this to happen in Syria? We used to be America. And when I asked him about who these rebels are, he goes, well, let's get in there and find out for ourselves. Why just sit and be bystanders? Do you agree with that?
I do agree that from the standpoint of intelligence collection and just understanding the lay of the land, we absolutely should do that. We should have been doing that weeks and even months ago. I'm less certain than Senator McCain is. I have a lot of respect for him, but he has been in favor of American intervention in Syria on behalf of the opposition. I think we have to be really careful about that.
And you say that not for a guy that just has experience. You were just there. So
not only do you have a theory,
but you actually witnessed it.
I've seen the damage that could be done by premature intervention. Yeah, I've been there.
This is a bonus from David Ignatius. He was going to come in at 34 after the hour. I said, can you come in a little bit early? Blood Money's the name of his paperback. You're back with more from him in just a moment.
It's Kilmeade and Friends.
Welcome back, everybody. David Ignatius is here, the outstanding reporter with the Washington Post, who's got a book out, now out in paperback, did very well, Blood Money. It's from his collection of experiences in one of the most volatile regions in the world, and has been, you could probably have said that, for the last 80 years. David, you are just back from a trip over to Egypt. You also stopped over in Lebanon, and you had a brief stint with the Syrian, I guess do we call them rebels?
Yeah, the Syrian opposition.
The opposition. Let's go with opposition now. All right, so first off, in Egypt, I'm concerned from Israel's perspective, do you blame them from feeling very wary about the unrest on their border?
No. from Israel's standpoint, what's happening in Egypt is genuinely scary. The situation in the Sinai Peninsula, which Israel gave up in the peace treaty with Egypt, is becoming increasingly dangerous. When I was in Egypt, I talked with a member of the Egyptian military about their plans with Israeli approval, which they'd need to send an armored battalion into the Sinai with as many as 30 tanks, 6 helicopters. I mean, they'd send a lot of firepower in to try to push back the insurgency that seems to be developing in parts of the Sinai in ways that are dangerous to Israel, but also dangerous to Egypt. So we'll see. I don't think a final decision has been made on that. There are consultations that are going on between Egypt and Israel. But to keep your eye focused on the Sinai, which if you want to look at a place that could blow up with major consequences for Israel, take a look at the Sinai.
So you would think on the surface that, okay, with Egypt having all their problems, internal problems, that they wouldn't even be focused on what's happening in Israel. Like, for example, you don't hear the Syrian opposition talking about taking over Israel or starting an insurgency there. But yet in Egypt, almost from the moment that Mubarak was ousted, we hear them shutting off the natural gas flow immediately and then opening up the border that was once sealed. And now we see Israel moving tanks near the Egyptian border. There seems to have been a big anti-Israeli sentiment that's been suppressed for the last few decades.
Well, I think it's just a fact that public opinion in the Arab world is takes the Palestinian issue really seriously. I mean, people shouldn't forget that for Arabs, this is like an open wound. And I think it's in Israel's security interest, quite apart from anything else, to try to find a way to resolve that. As the Arab world gets more democratic, and that's what's happening with this movement we call the Arab Spring, public opinion in the Arab world matters more to Israel. And so that's going to make for a really tough situation. That's why I say the dilemmas for Israeli policymakers now are really, really tough ones.
We got a lot of ground to cover. So let's talk about Egypt in particular, their political situation. They have an election. The Muslim Brotherhood representative wins, but the military very much in control. Today, massive demonstrations. You were just there. Where's this heading?
Well, right now you'd say it's heading towards a confrontation, a collision. I talked last week to the man that U.S. Embassy regards as really the chief strategist of the Muslim Brotherhood. He's a businessman named Hayrat al-Shatter. He was going to run for president but was disqualified right before the election. But he's, a lot of people think, the brains behind the throne. And he was very specific both in his offer to work with other parties if they get elected and are allowed to form a government, said all the nice things. But it was also quite worrying in his threats of what the Brotherhood might do if it's prevented from ruling, if the military steps in, or if the other candidate, Ahmed Shafiq, a former Air Force general, should win. I mean, he basically said, we'll be in the streets, and the next revolution in Egypt is not going to be as peaceful as the last one was. And that, I thought that was pretty scary, basically saying, you let us have power, we're going to burn the house down.
David Ignatius, our guest. But David, it seemed to me that a lot of those people that were part of the unrest that ousted Mubarak were students, were younger people, and it seems like the Muslim Brotherhood was on the outskirts.
They were late
to
the party.
What happened to those people that caused this uproar? Yes.
That's been the biggest disappointment, frankly, Brian, that I've seen. I was in Egypt 4 times last year and then just got back from this trip. The inability of the secular the protesters, the people who made that revolution in Tahrir Square, who moved all of us, I think, with their calls for a new kind of society, they just couldn't get it together to form a disciplined, successful political movement that could have taken power. There were a number of candidates competing for their vote. None of them was really charismatic. I mean, when I was in Egypt, I found people kind of dreading the choice between the Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand and a return to Mubarak and the Mubarak crowd, on the other hand, through this candidate, Shafiq. They just didn't like it. One person said this is like choosing between cholera and the plague. I mean, we don't want either. And I think that there's probably a middle majority in Egypt that wants something different. Right now they don't have the candidate for it. They're going to go through a bumpy period. We should keep sympathy with them, try to be patient. It is going to be a bumpy ride.
All right. So you have a Muslim Brotherhood candidate that might have to understand, too. I don't care what your belief is, but you got to get your economy going if you want to have any type of power. How, by getting women out of the workforce, taking them out of schools, is that going to be a major step backwards if Sharia law and the Muslim Brotherhood doctrine is put in place?
If they put all of their doctrine and try to impose Sharia law, the place is going to come to a standstill. Economy is going to go off a cliff. And they know that.
No tourism either.
Well, they don't have any tourism now, but they're certainly not going to get it back. Again, talking to this Muslim Brotherhood leader, al-Shatir, who is himself a businessman, worth millions, pretty conservative in his economic views, he says the right things. He says, we're going to work with the International Monetary Fund. We're going to work with investment banks, bankers around the world. We're going to convince foreign investors their money's safe in Egypt. Egypt's going to be open for business. I said to him, how are you going to get people back to work? Egypt has been plagued over the last year by waves of strikes, and it's just very hard to produce stuff. And he said, look, we're going to have a more just society so workers don't feel quite so much like they're on the outs. But we also have members of the Muslim Brotherhood in every factory. And we're going to make clear to people that it's time to go back to work. Now, you can argue that that's a good thing, that they're going to put some discipline in the workforce. You can argue it's a terrible thing. It's sort of fascistic that they're going to organize their cadres in every workplace. But that's part of what they're thinking. They know they have the organization and the tools to get the country back on a better footing.
What should we be doing? It doesn't seem like we're doing anything. Am I wrong?
We are basically standing back and letting Egyptians write their history, and I think that's the right thing to do. I think that it's been a mistake for us to try to intervene in everything that's happened in that part of the world. Let's face it, in places like Iraq, we got ourselves into a mess of trouble without really knowing what we're doing. And I think the American people kind of think let's not try to steer this every development. The Egyptians have got to sort this out either way. They'll resent us if we try to make it happen. And in truth, at this point, I don't think we'd know what the right thing to do is.
Well, if you're just there and that's your conclusion, I'll go with you. And I would hope the administration would contact you, honestly, because not to skew your columns, but to say, what did you see? Who'd you talk to?
Well, they all it costs is 50 cents and they can read the Washington Post. It's free online. But my columns are read in the administration. And I think, to be clear, Brian, I think the basic view that I've articulated, you got to watch this. The strategic patience is the phrase I've heard from our best State Department officials who know this well. And I think they're right. That's what we need to – we need to be patient. We need to be strategic. If our interests are threatened, for real, we got to intervene right away. If they're not, then don't get in a mess.
Well, okay. I grant you that. So that's an ally going through a massive transition, which is a reason for concern. Syria has been not an Iranian enemy, but right behind them in terms of people trying to undo American interest and influence in the region. We have a chance to rotate leadership for the first time in decades. What role should we be playing after speaking with the opposition a short time ago?
The Syrian opposition is strong, but it's very diffuse. I mean, it's everywhere, but it isn't organized into a solid force. That's why Bashar al-Assad still is holding on to power. Bashar al-Assad will never effectively be the president of Syria again. And everybody knows that.
How much of the country has he lost?
Well, the army still operates in most every part of the country, but if there was a more disciplined opposition, look at how the opposition in Iraq, which wasn't that many people, a few thousand people, drove the best military in the world, the United States, crazy. A more disciplined opposition that hits you in Idlib and then recedes and hits you in Homs and then recedes and hits you in Deraa. These are all the names of Syrian towns in different parts of the country. Pretty soon it's going to stretch that Syrian army so thin that it's going to begin to crack. That's what I'd guess. So what the CIA is doing now, according to this morning's reporting on Fox and in the New York Times, is getting to know this opposition. Who are they? Who are the people you might want to provide non-lethal support to? What these people need right now, they got a lot of guns. They need command and control. They need to be able to talk to each other. They need to be able to say –
Well, we promised them phone system. We promised them communication equipment anyway. That was
– I think that's more important in this situation than you might think. These are – they're called local coordination committees, and they're really local. I mean, they're based around mosques, and they don't have unified command and control. And they need it. The only point I'd make, Brian, is that this is a part of the world where you have to be careful about setting off an avalanche of sectarian warfare. This war in Syria is becoming a war of Sunnis who were enraged against Bashar al-Assad, who's an Alawite, which is a kind of Shia sect. So it's becoming Sunnis against Shias. And we saw what could happen in Iraq when the bodies piled up. And there were 100-150 bodies a day ending up in the Baghdad morgue as this thing became a sectarian civil war.
Right.
That's what General Petraeus figured out a way to stop. But it's beginning in Syria. And when I was in Lebanon, I'll tell you, you just could begin to hear the fabric rip towards Lebanon, where you have Sunnis who are furious at Shias, and you have a war just, you know, kind of on ice, ready to go.
His novels are really based off his real-life experience about what's happening in the world. The latest one is out on paperback, Blood Money. David Ignatius is here from The Washington Post. We're going to talk again, Dave, when we come back, hopefully a little bit about the leaks and how much damage, if any, you believe is done to our national security by what's in David Sanger's books and the follow-up articles in The New York Times. Kill me and friends.
Don't agree with Brian?
What's he doing? What's he thinking?
Engage in some friendly fire. You're with Kill Me and Friends.
David Ignatius here, one of America's finest international writers. He's got this great book out called Blood Money, now out on paperback. What I always love is factored in what's true and what's not true, because David's seen so much working for the Washington Post and other outlets. David just back from the most volatile region in the world. You talk about Egypt, you talk about Syria, you talk about Lebanon. But I got to ask you, there's another major story percolating here, and that's about the amount of leaks coming out of the White House into David Sanger's book and follow-up articles with the New York Times. Between the ISI now knowing that we've been listening in on their conversations, between it's now apparent that the president has his own kill list, to the drone strikes, to now we find out that the Stuxnet virus is definitely an American-Israeli operation, and this flame virus, computer virus, also an American-Israeli operation. How much damage is done, David?
The truth is we don't know, but almost certainly some damage is done. And I'm a journalist, so I look at this from the perspective of somebody who believes that the public should think about these sensitive national security issues, that there's a part of this debate that's appropriate to have in public. Where are the lines? That's the question that the books like this raise. I was amazed by the level of detail that was in David Sanger's book. I mean, David is a great reporter, so he got details you thought were ungettable. And it's a tough question for journalists, for their editors, to decide what are the details the public really ought to know so it can have an informed debate, and what are the details that aren't necessary. My editor at the Washington Post for so many years, Ben Bradley, used to say, the public doesn't need to know the wiring diagram. I mean, that's not essential to having an informed public debate. And so for decades at the Washington Post, we've had a system where if we get some sensitive national security information, we go to the affected agencies and say, this is what we're thinking of running. Tell us, is there damage that's going to be done to U.S. interests, to people's lives, if we publish that? And we listen carefully to what people say. And then we make what we think are the right decisions. You'd be amazed at how much that reporters find out doesn't end up getting into the newspapers, doesn't end up getting into books. So, I mean, I'm sure that's true with David Sanger and the New York Times. They have a similar process. In this case, people are upset, and understandably, by whatever process or review that people think too much ended up getting on the public record. And we're now going to have an investigation of that, legal investigation. Again, as a journalist, I have to lean in the side of the idea that the public right. ought to have information so it makes good decisions.
But if the administration didn't push back on a lot of this intelligence getting out, and I know only one area in which they did keep something out, if they didn't push back, it leads one to believe from the outside that they were not unhappy that this information is out, because it makes them look like they're aggressively pursuing the war on terror and have a plan, and the president looks great.
I think administrations, and this one is the latest, end up working with writers who are doing books about national security because they want to shape a story that they figure is going to be written one way or another in a positive direction. You look at Bob Woodward's books. My colleague Bob Woodward at the Washington Post has written a series of books about the most sensitive decisions the Bush administration took in the war on terror, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. I mean, there was a lot of leaked material. A friend of mine who worked on the 9/11 Commission said that when the fight was going on about what to declassify in the 9/11 Commission report, they prepared an index copy of Bob Woodward's book, Bush at War, to take to the White House and say, what do you mean you're going to keep this classified? It's already in, you already put it out in the book.
I remember they said that, you know, we saw what Bob Woodward's done in the past, and we thought, let's cooperate. Because
people make those decisions.
Yeah.
So, and it's clear that the Obama administration made a similar decision. And you can question that in each of these cases. Should they just shut up and say, I don't care what you're going to write.
Right.
This information is classified, and we're not going to talk about it, period. People say that to me all the time, and I say, okay. I mean, if somebody says that to me, I say, okay. But that is the responsibility of the government official to make that decision. I think if people draw an absolute line, we couldn't have any discussion about foreign policy, because almost everything these days ends up being classified in some form. So you have to have a rule of reason. But again, in the first instance, it is up to government officials in every administration, now the Obama administration, to decide what's fit to be discussed in public and what isn't.
He wrote Body of Lies, and that was made into a movie with Leo DiCaprio, who's a pretty good actor, and Russell Crowe. Blood Money, give me a line. Tell me if I haven't read it.
Blood Money is about the things that we're discussing this week in the press. It's about drone attacks. It opens in a part of the tribal areas. It's under a drone attack. It's about the crazy Pakistani intelligence service and how we got tied in knots with it. And it's ultimately about how these wars in this part of the world are going to end.
Got to go get it. Blood Money. David, always love having you in. We need another 3 hours. Is that
possible?
It's
great talking to you, Brian. Sure. Love to come back.
Hey, thanks for listening to Kill Me to Friends.